Hey, what's up? This is Seth with SethFerlo.com and the Executive Function Online Summit. I'm really stoked to be back with you here today with Debbie Steinberg-Kuntz, who I know pretty well. And she wears a lot of hats. She started the Bright and Quirky Online Conference, which is a conference really geared towards 2E kids. For those who don't know, 2E is twice exceptional kids who are gifted and talented and have learning disabilities, namely often executive function challenges in some way, shape, or form. And she is a licensed marriage and family therapist out of the Seattle area. She specializes a lot in 2E and twice exceptional kids. She does support groups for parents raising 2E kids. And yeah, and this is Debbie. So howdy.
Hi, how you doing, Seth?
Good. Debbie's going to be talking to us today about smart and struggling students. And sort of the subtitle of this is, you've got these kids who are at the 99th percentile in certain things, like with their IQ, and then they're in the 9th percentile or whatever, some super low percentile when it comes to executive function. And I see this a lot when I get neuropsych reports, because I've read a lot of neuropsych reports. And so I'm excited to dive into this with you. So let's do a bit of background, Debbie. And before we even get into your professional background, let's tell people who you are personally, where you're at, what you're into, what your hobbies and interests are. Who are you outside of work?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, first and foremost, I'm a mom. I've got two twice exceptional boys, both with ADHD. So I live this journey every day. And also my dad has ADHD, and went through his childhood in the 40s and 50s with no ADHD diagnosis. So this, you know, ADHD is genetic, and so you tend to have similar patterns going on through the generations. We love music. Both of my kids are musicians. I also play guitar. I know you play guitar, Seth. Mm-hmm. And we're figuring things out, and I've got an online business in addition to my private practice, and we got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, so talk to us about your professional background. What do you want us to know? What should we know in terms of how you got to where you're at professionally and the different hats that you wear?
Well, I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I've been in private practice for about a decade and started in general family practice. And then when I had my kids and was, you know, my coping strategy when I need to figure out what's going on is I do research. I roll up my sleeves and I try to figure out what's going on. And I started to sort of be known as a go-to therapist for twice exceptional kids in the Seattle area. And with big high-tech companies like Microsoft and Amazon, we've got lots of twice exceptional kids and parents here. Most don't know that they're twice exceptional till they get some sort of testing. And then I started to have parent support groups for parents raising 2E kids, and then started the online summit. And really hit a nerve all around the world. These kids are in every country on the planet.
Cool. So what would you say is your superpower when you're working with a family or a student?
I would say my superpower is connection. I think anytime you work with a therapist, if the connection isn't there, chances are the therapy is not going to be as effective. So I really spend a lot of time sort of joining with the client, building relationship and rapport. My office is about a block from a chocolate shop, so sometimes we go on a walk and get a piece of chocolate. But I love what I do, and I love our families, and I feel very honored and privileged to be able to do this work that is life-changing and enjoyable.
It's funny because as I've been interviewing everybody, I hear a lot of the same themes come up in different ways. And one of them, in terms of the superpower with connection, the importance of connection is so big. And I really do see that when a lot of times when there's a breakdown with students in school, a lot of times it's the relationship. There's a relationship with the teacher that just feels disconnected.
Yeah, and let me tell you, I mean, I really focus on relationship, but as a mom raising kids with challenges in executive function, believe me, no matter how much you know, this dynamic can rear its ugly head when you're least expecting it. So we have created some ways of working together and some strategies to, alleviate the headbutting. So I'm happy to share those here.
Cool. Yeah. And it's good to hear too, the human part, that the stuff still happens. You're not superhuman. Somebody else who I just interviewed said the same thing. Like he's still a dad. He's still, they still have these struggles. He said he feels better that he has good tools to work with it, but we are human. And I think that that's really important for parents to hear too, because I think a lot of times parents feel isolated or ashamed, like they're the only one and they're a bad parent and they're not doing it right. And everybody else seems to be doing it right. And that is not the case. Otherwise we wouldn't be doing this. You wouldn't be doing the Bright and Quirky. So
yeah, especially kids who are twice exceptional, where you've got this very high intelligence and then these brain-based challenges like ADHD or autism or learning differences or all of them at the same time, these kids can really feel bad, broken, have very low self-esteem because of the messages they're getting from society, because the way that things are organized in the school system, in the mental health world, is if you get a diagnosis, there's a list of negative attributes, and we're not focusing enough on strengths. And that is sort of the special sauce that I want to talk about. Because when you look at people with executive function that become successful adults, they're doing something very specific that I've heard from many adults, and it's not focusing on their weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. And the strengths-based approach is another theme that is really cool to hear over and over. So before we start diving into that, give us a definition, just sort of a medium-sized definition, unpack 2E a little bit for us.
Okay.
For the parent who's never heard of it.
Okay, if you've never heard of it, I like to call these kids bright and quirky, because you kind of know if you have a bright and quirky kid. And what do I mean by bright? The child could be officially gifted. You could have had them tested for IQ, and you know that their IQ is above 120 or 130. Or your child's just bright, or they're really good in something. Anything in which they're advanced, that's going to be one exception to the norm. And then on the other end of the spectrum, twice exceptional kids have one area in which they are behind. And that could be executive function, it could be self-regulation, emotional regulation, it could be social skills, it could be reading, writing, math. There's a lot of ways to be advanced and behind at the same time. But because these kids are so unique, it's really a niche, and chances are your teacher, your school, your doctor, your counselor, your friends have never heard of 2E. So,
and why is that?
I think because it is so unique. You know, we've got three silos in your typical public school of gifted education, general education, and special education. And the way that the system works now is chances are you're in one silo. And when you have two exceptions or more, you don't fit neatly into any silo. And so what can happen is kids have this broken or bad feeling, and this dynamic can start to take hold at home, which is, come on, let's get with the program. You're checked out. You're not engaged. You're not getting your homework done. And it's all these talking about deficits within the child, where really, if you think about our educational system and how it came about through the Industrial Revolution, it's simply not geared for the way our kids' brains are wired. And you know, Seth, that the ADHD brain has so many benefits. You know, these kids are the out-of-the-box thinkers. They're the innovators. They tend to be charismatic. They tend to be collaborative. I was just at a conference, and we were talking about a 2E school and how they do projects in the classroom. And they said the kids with ADHD, they are thinkers. They're thinking of lots of different ideas, and then they go to the playground. And then our kids that are on the spectrum, they dive into the details and they really get it done. So we really want to build self-awareness in these kids, play to their strengths. And, you know, with a traditional school system, that can often feel like being a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat something you just said. We really want to build self-awareness in these kids. We often don't do that. And play to their strengths. So I'm in total alignment with you because the self-awareness, the metacognition, the really understanding who you are as a learner or a feeler or a social being or whatever, we often can't describe that until we're way older, which is a shame because we have plenty of knowledge and research and stuff to teach kids to have better tools around this. It's not a part of the way we do things. And then in terms of playing to the strengths, that is what these kids are going to build their future on, hopefully. Right. So awesome. So how do you define then executive function? Can you define it in a sentence or so? And then can you unpack what that is? So if a parent's never heard of executive function, what's your quick answer? And then unpack that a little bit for us.
You know, I don't know what the official definition is, but we just did a survey with parents and we got back some answers that fall into the executive function camp. So my child has trouble staying on task, focusing, managing time, trouble with distractions, turning homework in, meeting deadlines, procrastinating, avoidance, losing paperwork, rushing through work. Their grades and test scores don't match. So when they think about their top challenges, this is what it sounds like in everyday life. I think when we use the term executive function, it sounds so clinical, but that's how it shows up day to day.
I love it. Perfect. Awesome. So parents, I think, can definitely relate to those things. So now when you are working with a family or an individual student child, and the student in particular is at this point A, they first come to you. And then you help them transform their experience, and then they get to a point B where the family's like, thank you, we're in a really good place, awesome. What does point A look like more specifically? For people coming to you, what are parents saying, we need help with this and that, or the student saying, I'm struggling with this, and then what does point B look like in your practice?
Point A sometimes looks like, we're struggling with this, can you help? Often, especially with teenagers and their parents, it can look like he said he was going to do this and he doesn't. He says he wants to be a better student and he's not. There's sort of like this blame game, very toxic sort of thing, which is really hard and really disheartening because kids want to do well. I think Ross Green's phrase is kids do well if they can. And I really believe that that's true. So often, when they come for counseling, we start with de-escalation and educating them, you know, that kids would do well if they can. And then we really...
What's de-escalation?
De-escalation means, you know, people come in crisis. Mm. They're feeling very anxious. There can be a lot of anger. It's just a very negative, fearful, hopeless place. So job number one is to bring hope in, because I've worked with many people who have done really well. And this is something you don't want to do on your own. You really need people who have worked with a lot of people, because you don't know what's going to work for each child. As you know, Seth, we have to do a lot of experimentation, which I call being a self-scientist. So that's really sort of the cornerstone of what I do. And when I talk to adults with 2E who are successful, they say, you know what? I had to do a lot of trial and error, or I like to call it trial and insight, to find out what works for the unique way that my brain is wired. And I like to give the example of our mornings were just crazy when my kids were little, and we said, okay, let's sit down, let's have a conversation. What can make them smoother? Okay, kids, what is preventing you from going out the door smoothly? And they said, the socks, we can never find our socks. So this is executive function, it's planning. So we said, okay, let's put the socks right by the door. And we just took an old pasta pot and put them next to the, you know, inside the coat closet, and all the socks were there. That tiny little change made all the difference. And I call those tiny little changes 1% gains. Mm. And they seem so simple. I mean, we have our huge gains, which would be something like taking medication. If you have ADHD, that can be a huge game changer. But also the 1% gains of putting the socks by the door can make all the difference.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So you get people there in crisis mode. The first thing you do need to do is de-escalate, which is kind of getting them out of the crisis mode and then starting to work on some of the self-investigated, what did you call it?
Self-scientist.
Scientist, thank you.
Yeah, or self-hacking.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so you start unpacking that and you eventually get to a point where, what's it look like?
Well, I have a 5-step process that we go through.
Can we go through that?
Let's go through it.
Okay, let's hear that.
Yeah, and so we start by looking at their limiting beliefs, and most people come in with a fix-it mentality that my child has these problems and we need to fix it. I think one of our parents in our survey said, how do I resolve these executive function issues before high school starts? You know, and as you know, there is no magic fix. This is managing the way that a brain is wired and figure out what makes your brain happy. So we really want to work on those limiting beliefs of going from that fix-it mentality to a strength mentality. What are the gifts that are to be unwrapped with this child? You know, if you get a neuropsych assessment, which you can do by seeing a clinical psychologist who does testing, you want to find someone, if you suspect your child is bright and quirky, you want to go to someone who understands twice exceptionality. And that testing can help you figure out what your child is good at. You can also just look at, what do they like to talk about? What do they like to do? What would they do if they had a free day? You know, a lot of people are going to say video games. Well, what is it about video games that are, you know, interesting? So we really want to take our fix-it mentality and try on a new perspective, which is blowing on the embers of their strengths. Then we really want to identify what the challenges are. And again, a neuropsych assessment can be super helpful. But also you can talk to your child's teacher. You can just observe, maybe keep a log for a week or two. And what is difficult? You know, kids with executive function challenges often, different parts of the daily routine can be difficult, either getting out the door in the morning, going to sleep, getting homework done, chunking down long-term assignments. Time management is so difficult. I interviewed Jessica McCabe a few years back from How to ADHD, and I loved how she put it. She said, you know, some kids are born knowing how to do this, and it's sort of like driving an automatic car, and some aren't, and they're driving a manual car. So by building that self-awareness of saying, what are my challenges? You could say, okay, these things come automatically to me, and you might be way more advanced than other people in certain areas. And then you could say, well, these things are really challenging and I'm on manual and I'm going to, you know, let's say I have trouble socially. I'm going to have to say in my head, oh, that person is smiling. I guess maybe they liked my joke. Maybe I'll tell another one, but there's a different internal dialogue. So you want to identify the challenges. And then we really want to develop those strengths. I also interviewed Robin Shader, and she has an idea called being an opportunity maker. We really want to invest time as parents to expose our kids to many things to see what they might be interested in. Seth, I'm guessing you might have been exposed to music as a child and found that you like guitar. It could be something athletic. It could be games like Magic or Dungeons and Dragons. It could be, you know, so many different things. The arts, coding, robotics, you name it. So the name of the game is exposure. And, you know, we're living in a culture right now that is really geared towards early specialization, like select soccer and gymnastics and just doing one thing. And I would really encourage the opposite, lots of early exposure to many things.
So here's something that I hear, that I've heard many times over the years, where a parent will say, yeah, my kid is signed up for violin and that we signed him up 4 weeks ago and they're already bored of it. I wonder if, what you would say in that situation. It's probably similar to what I would say, but they're like, I want them to stick with it. I want them to follow through. But what do you think about that?
Well, that sort of goes into the next step of what we do, which is experimentation and learning to be a self-scientist and what works for your brain. So you really want to set up these experiments and say, okay, so you want to try violin. Let's set up the experiment that you take 8 lessons and then we can reevaluate. But you're going to stick with it for 8 lessons. We're not going to buy the violin. We're going to rent the violin. And your part of the agreement is to go to all 8, practice, and then we'll have another meeting and we'll see what we want to do.
So you sort of put a structure, an experimental structure around it proactively, which we probably a lot of times are more reactive and not really thinking forward and then responding in a way that doesn't feel good for anybody.
Right. Right.
So let's back up. So there were the 3. The first one was
sort of getting a new perspective.
The mindset, the perspective.
Yeah. And then
the challenge areas,
identifying the challenges,
right? And now the self-experiment,
developing strengths.
Oh, developing
and then experiments. Then the last stage is really a lifelong thing that we're all doing, which is self-actualization. You know, if you think of Maslow's pyramid, there's a lot of things that need to be in place to self-actualize. We need a huge thing is psychological safety, and that's what so many kids are missing at school, because if you're constantly getting these messages that you are less than,
it's daunting.
It's super daunting. It's super daunting. So we really want to try to structure their school experience to play to their strengths. We want to help them get the most engaging teachers and teachers who have flexibility that might be open to different ways of learning. You know, if we have a child who, a lot of our kids with executive function challenges also have trouble with writing. Well, how else could they show their learning? Could they do a comic? Could they write a soundtrack with their instrument? We really want to start thinking out of the box, and then as I become a self-scientist and I run these experiments and learn what works for my brain, I can self-actualize. I can become more fully me and accept that I'm wired the way I'm wired and I have a unique path in the world, and I'm going to hopefully get in my lane of what is interesting to me and engaging, and then get help with the things that I'm bad at.
And what are some of the, as you're going through this process with people, what are some of the blind spots? I know you've actually mentioned a couple of them, particularly with mindset, but what are some of the blind spots that parents might come in with?
I think the biggest one is that it's just so natural to fall into the trap of becoming a nag as a parent and then getting that really difficult relationship. So I think one of the key things is, as parents, we need to work on ourselves. You know, when we get caught in that dynamic, I have to remind myself that one of our most useful things is to set an appointment. When I ask my child, you know, I really want to do X, can we set an appointment to talk about it? Their answer is always yes. And then they know it's coming. It's a respectful thing to do to, you know, I would say to my friend, do you want to set a time to go for a walk or have a cup of coffee? It's what we do with our friends. So I find that is super helpful. So we want to work on ourselves, work on our own escalation, our own, I'm so frustrated, and vent to a friend, vent to our partner, get our own good sleep and exercise. And really, we are the source of electricity for our child's light. We really have to take care of ourselves to empower them the way that they need. And yeah, it's very hard, especially when we're all so busy.
So if a parent's watching and they're listening and they're saying, yeah, I would love to do or do, you know, really work on myself and really do my self-care, but I don't know where to start. Or if there's a parent watching, they're like, I don't really have anything that I need to be working on. Do you find that when parents come to you that you have some parents that aren't aware that they have things to work on?
No, I think everyone feels like they have things to work on. I think
most people, by the time they get to you, they're on that path. So then where do they start?
You know, it depends what's going on, really.
Okay.
But we want to
start
with
talk about
one
the relationship.
Thing.
Where do they start? Because they have this going on. A lot of families have this conflict going on, and they have to de-escalate. Are there things that a family can do on their own at home this week where they can start working on themselves or de-escalating themselves or getting used to their own, learning more about their own patterns that they may not be aware of?
Starting with themselves?
Yeah.
You know, I would really look at what is your number one challenge right now. Pick your number one challenge. We want to just pick one thing and say, what 1% gain could I focus on that would make things different for me? It could be sleep. It could be calling a friend. It could be setting an appointment with your child. It could be, you talk about the sacred study space. It could be just cleaning off the desk. You know, what is the 1% thing? Let's not change the whole world right now. Just what's the 1% step?
I like that, because I think sometimes we can get so overwhelmed because there are so many things. Like, pick one and just do something. I also like the appointment idea, and I talk about that in a different way, but what I want to hear from you is, what's the opposite of the appointment thing? What do parents often do habitually that's not that?
Well, I think, and probably so many parents listening recognize this dynamic, is just getting into it at the moment. You know, your homework's not done. You've been hanging out for 3 hours. Nothing is done. Nothing has been started. You know, this exasperation.
So it's just this habituated pattern that, and then I think what happens is that they'll just start in on the kid rather than saying,
yes,
hey, we need to talk about this at such and such time. It's just emotional, and the kid feels blindsided, and what you're trying to do is not accomplished.
Exactly. And there are a lot of things you can do. And I would say, start with this idea of being a self-scientist. Now, first of all, we've had a lot more luck with someone else being the homework keeper when the kids were younger. You know, we actually brought an executive function coach in who helped the kids get some of these skills. And it can be really helpful, even if it's just a high school or college student down the street, to take yourself out of the equation so you don't have that dynamic. Kids tend to, in many cases, tend to be more cooperative with people who aren't their parents. So having someone else in there can be super helpful. And then also being a self-scientist in terms of, okay, it's difficult to get started. What are some of the things you can do to get started? Let's experiment. And we've talked before that for my kids, they know that getting their heart rate up really helps them. So one will go shoot hoops, another will go play drums. So what will get you ready to get started? Sometimes it's chewing a strong smelling spearmint gum. Sometimes it's having a snack. Sometimes it's getting the phone very far away. So those 1% gain, little experiments, being a self-scientist is, and you'll be right on the money there.
And it's funny because this is not woo, this is real life, real simple things. You and I were just talking before the interview. I went and took a walk around the block and you were doing jumping jacks.
Yes.
As adults, we've discovered these little things that we can do, but our kids really need help learning how to be the self-scientist, and I think becoming conscious of it, because we can learn things on our subconscious and when we're not really conscious of it, but something works for us, it doesn't do us much good unless we luckily do the thing that helps. But here, the self-scientist is raising awareness of what's working.
Right. So as a parent, as you feel your own irritation rising, one thing you can do is take a deep breath and ask the question, what does your brain need right now? And that hands it over to the child to they might say, I don't know, but you could say what worked last time. You could make a list on a post-it of 5 things they can do when they feel like it's hard to get started. And another thing is that sometimes we have to drop our expectations because we might want our child to come home from school, have a snack, and start homework. One of my kids really, for whatever reason, couldn't kick it in until either 8 p.m. or 7 a.m. So one of them often did their homework before school. They just couldn't focus at night. Sometimes when there's medication wearing off, there can be a bit of a crash. So also loosening your expectations about when things get done can help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's another recurring theme is that parents have an idea about how things should be or how development should be. And we really sometimes have to let go of that. Do you find that's a hard process sometimes for parents to have to let go of their preconceived ideas of how things were supposed to turn out?
Huge, huge. I mean, preconceived ideas about grades, preconceived ideas about what should be happening developmentally at what age. And our 2-week kids really need the gift of time. They really do. And with grades, not every child has to go to an Ivy League college. You know, it's very common for our 2-week kids to be brilliant, but not have their grades reflect that they're brilliant. Very, very common. And then there's the whole conversation about school choices. You know, there's many, many things we can do to make the school experience better in a traditional school, but then some parents opt for a private school or for homeschooling or some sort of hybrid combination. So I would really say, and this is a lot of what we do at Bright and Quirky, is just open your mind to lots of possibilities and know that executive function, helping kids function, is not a quick fix. It's about finding the lane of thriving for the way that your brain is uniquely wired.
Tell us what that means a little bit. Finding the lane of thriving for the way your brain is uniquely wired.
I believe that there is a path for everyone, a very positive path for them to self-actualize, to become fully who they are in a happy, productive, successful way that works for the way their brain is wired. It is not about fixing something that is broken. I think that's a really important point because you won't hear that from sort of the main traditional establishment. That's very much about fixing what's wrong. But I have just seen so many benefits with ADHD. You know, our school system is very much sit and be quiet and still and listen and be lectured at for many, many hours of the day. But that's a relatively new phenomenon in the history of humanity. I think our ADHD kids were probably way better off when we were hunter-gatherers. But it's important to think of environmental fitting with the system that you're in, with the structure that you're in. That's why a lot of our 2E families homeschool or do some sort of hybrid or speak to the teachers about having wiggle seats or being able to pace in the back of the classroom or be able to be the child who brings the books to the library and brings things to the office just to put more movement in the day. Mm-hmm. So I really want parents to recognize that the name of the game is finding a lifestyle that works for this unique wiring. And I know it is definitely not easy, rather than fixing.
Mm-hmm. And I really like you. You talk so much about the strengths. And when you have a family who's in a school where they really are focused on challenges and deficits, and they're really not building your strengths. And maybe your child's strengths aren't even measured in school. For example, they may be a really visual spatial kid who's amazing with Legos and building stuff and inventing things, but nobody gives them a grade on that. And you talked about exposure to many different activities, to many different fields, to many different areas to explore. How, if you have a family who they really are in a school that just is not engaging for the student, how can they sort of build these strengths, or are there ways that you recommend that people go and find things to be exposed to creatively? Or
yeah, first of all, you really want to look if the light is in your child's eyes. A lot of our kids, the light is not in their eyes. They're bored, they're checked out, zoned out, underachieving, refusing school, refusing homework. This is very serious, and this can become a severe mental health issue.
I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, with anxiety, with depression, action absolutely has to be taken. If you have the luxury of changing school environment or homeschooling, a lot of times we look at that, and even, I mean, this is, sounds crazy, but even a gap year in the middle of schooling, not after high school. Mm-hmm. Because if our kids are in a really bad way, they might need a couple of months of unschooling, mm-hmm. and then a new environment.
Tell us what unschooling is for those who've never heard of that.
Unschooling means just putting the books away and letting their interests drive their learning. You know, maybe you're bopping around going to museums, getting lots of library books, having lots of things to build with. You know, it's really based on their interests. Maybe yeah. they are doing a coding class. There's tons of online learning. But it's really taking the pressure off to get the light back in their eyes. So it's not about grades. It's not about conformity. It's about kind of saving their soul when they're really off track and really sad.
I think we're in such a culture where we really do want things so fast, and we really expect change to happen so fast. And I think it's sometimes hard to comprehend, like you said, take months off. And I remember I busted my back a few years back, and I was on my back for almost 4 months. I basically would lay on my back and work with kids, and that, like, I would go home, just be on my back, icing or whatever, go into work. Go home, and this was about 4 months, and I needed all that time and more. But like, and you're speaking more about emotional healing, and anyhow, can you speak to that? Just how patient we have to be, because sometimes healing, it's not. And I also think it's even related to what you said. You think your kids should come home from school, have a snack, do their homework. Sometimes it's not going to happen that day. Like they have off days. Part of the problem with this system is they can have an off day, and it can really have a cascading effect, especially for kids who struggle with this stuff. And to imagine, you know, reclimbing up their mountain to do all their makeup work. But anyhow, can you speak to some of the, I guess, the patience we need to have as adults around? And I think you've said this in so many ways today, really, but the patience we need to have around, they're on their own time schedule, and it's okay.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to say the kids who are really not in a good way, underachieving and checking out and battling anxiety or depression, that is definitely not the majority of kids I see. It's a very small fraction of kids that I see. Most kids, we can do a lot within their existing environment. I find that meeting with teachers can be very helpful. The advocacy piece you can get in the American schools, you can get what's called a 504 or an IEP, and you basically work to get special accommodations for either less work or different kinds of work. But yes, our brains are constantly growing. Executive function is not fully on board, is it, till age 25, I think? Yeah. So many people just need that gift of time to develop. And often it is letting go of our own expectations of where they should be. And believe me, I have had to do this work on my own expectations. It's not easy, especially when you see so much potential in your kids and you're like, can you just get it together? Because you have so much potential. But you know what? The brain is wired the way it's wired. And there's no doubt in my mind that the majority of kids that we work with, if we go back and we do a before and after and we check in with them at 30 years old, if they have the right supports in place along the way, they're going to be thriving. So we don't want to make things so dark and difficult on the way. Right. We really have to promote having that light in their eyes above all else and a good close relationship.
The connection you were speaking of earlier.
Yeah.
And the light in their eyes comes from the building of the strengths base. So even if the school is not there, developing those strengths in your kid, getting them involved in experiences that develop the strengths. And then my mind always goes to, well, what about the kid that says, which is a lot of them, my strength is video games. Follow my passion. My passion is video games. Do you want to speak to that?
Sure. I don't necessarily think video games are that bad a thing. I think too much video games is too bad a thing, just like too much junk food is not a good thing. I see kids playing certain games that are very social, playing with their friends. Uh-huh. And whereas they might have been doing it offline in the past, if it promotes social connection, I'm okay with that. And if it gives them a huge hit of excitement and hopefully learning, in our house, we've always made a distinction between online time that is entertainment and online time that's educational. The kids can compose music online. They can code. I mean, they need a lot of computer skills. So I think finding what you think is an acceptable amount and knowing that it is social currency, especially for our boys, to be on video games. And like anything, you want to have structure and parameters and be clear on what is acceptable, what is not, how much time is acceptable. And I'm a huge fan of using parental controls to limit access to what kinds of apps they can get. And for us, all of our devices have a curfew. It all goes through the router and everything turns off at a certain time. And I find the more that you can use those parental controls where technology is managing it, that takes the that headbutting distress out of it.
And as we start getting to wrap up, are there any other models or vocabulary words that we need to know or anything like that when we're thinking of this kid, this gifted 2E kid at the 99th percentile in certain things and the 9th percentile or, you know, who are really struggling with executive function? Are there any other super big ideas you want to share?
I would just think of that child as having a mixture of advanced and behind abilities, and we really can't separate them. We really have to always focus on strengths and interests, blowing on those embers and shoring up what they're not as good at and getting help with that. So to really look at the whole child and support both sides, not just the remediation.
Awesome. Before I ask a couple wrap-up questions, is there anything else you wanted to go that I'm leaving out? Okay. So what specific actions can parents take this week to get started helping their child with your insights?
I can think of two things. One is go have fun together.
Love it.
So much of the stress that can happen between parent and kids is always about having an agenda to progress executive function and everything else. We can really make this, our child, a project. And that can, if you think of your relationship as an emotional bank account, those interactions are withdrawals. What are the deposits are the fun times you have together. So think about what puts the light in your child's eyes. What puts the light in your eyes? Is it going to a ball game together, going for a bike ride, going to an animal shelter and walking dogs together, baking together, whatever it is. Go have some fun and put some deposits in the emotional bank account. The other thing I would say is it can be so helpful, and we're doing this at Bright and Quirky right now in our Idea Lab, is creating a one-sheet advocacy letter for your child with his strengths and challenges that you can give to the teacher, email it to her either before school starts or first week of school to say, hey, I thought you might like to know a little bit more about my child and what we found is helpful. And that will save a lot of learning curve. And I love the idea of an advocacy letter.
Awesome. I love both those ideas. I think you're absolutely right. Like, we need to take time to enjoy our relationship with our kids and not even bring up any school issues or anything at all during that time. And kind of like you said before with the appointment idea, is to prep them in terms of almost like this is an appointment where you tell them, by the way, we will not be talking about anything about school or anything like that unless you want to. Like, so similar to the appointment thing in terms of you're mentally preparing them that they can actually, okay. Like, that's very important to these kids. And then the advocacy letter, I'm a huge advocate of as well. And I want to mention with your advocacy letter idea that they don't have to have a 504 or an IEP at all for you to send that letter. Don't Correct. Think that you need to wait for that. If you got to wait months for your process or whatever, that a caring and compassionate teacher will read the letter. Now, the problem is that they have 25, 30, 35 kids at the beginning of the year. So I do recommend resending it a couple of times saying, hey, just, I know you already got this, not trying to bug you, but here it is in case you didn't have time.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Awesome. I have one final question for you.
Okay.
So there's a parent watching right this second. They're really worried and they're really concerned. They're really struggling and they really are here because they really want to get as much solution for their kid as they can. And they're worried. From your heart to theirs, what is the most important takeaway you hope they'll leave with right now?
I know how much you love your child. And if you work on one thing at a time and focus on the relationship and fueling the strengths, your child is going to be okay. And if you could take a breath and put your fears aside for just a moment, and know that that's really the place to focus is the strengths and the loving relationship and do one thing at a time, things are going to be okay.
That's so good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Debbie. And parents out there, go take some action. I'll see you in the next one.